Okay, welcome back. It's Friday night, end of a week. Roger Long, we're going to have a lot of fun tonight, as we always do when Harry Cooper joins us. Harry is the president, founder, and the man who makes it all happen at Shark Hunters International, the world's foremost repository of history and reality of World War II, and with an emphasis on German U-boats, but certainly honoring men who flew and submerged and floated on the oceans under all flags. It's quite a unique organization, and some of the people who have been members of it are, shall we say, famous, as in Ronald Reagan and others. And Harry just came back from one of the wonderful Shark Hunters patrols. He takes groups out a couple, three times a year. They go to South America to see where the man and Eva Braun went. They study that. They go to Europe to look at what's left of World War II remembrances, as they were there. But if you know anything about Berlin, it is said that half the city was underground by the end of the war. I mean, they just did amazing earthworks underneath there. This patrol we're going to talk about tonight is the Shark Hunters Southern Patrol with Harry Cooper. And I assume he is standing by or sitting down, hopefully, and relaxing after another long week. Are you there, Harry?
Yeah, I'm sitting down here.
Good man.
Good evening.
Good evening to you. So how long have you been back? Let's see, this you ended, when did you come back from this trip? 2 weeks?
Yeah, it's been about 2 weeks. And then I've got about another week, and I'm off to Honduras for 2 weeks.
What's the link there?
Just...
All right, I got it.
Some history. And then January, of course, is the important one. We're going to Argentina again, but that's... We can touch on that if you wish later.
We shall. We shall. Interesting. Wherever there is history, and Harry Cooper can get the resources and time to work on it, he goes. He goes. And if you're with us now and able to get to your computer, and most of you are, some of you are listening on portable devices, but even then, you can go to our guest section, look under Harry's name, and you'll see the word photos, which is a complete giveaway as to what we're going to do. We're going to take a photo trip with Harry and revisit the Southern Patrol that just occurred in Europe. Beside that, what are we going to talk about just for openers? What's new with Shark Hunters? I mean, you've got a monthly magazine. Tell the people about the organization, because there are veterans out there that should join.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The Shark Hunters originally started strictly for U-boat history. And as we got further into it, we realized that, we learned that U-boats were used for more than just attacking ships and supplying other U-boats at sea. They were used for running agents and material and valuables to many points in the world, but primarily Argentina. There's a little town, San Antonio Oeste. Now, anybody who speaks Spanish is probably laughing over my pronunciation, but that's a little tiny town at Caleta de los Loros, which is Parrot Bay on Golfo San Matias. And in this little town was the headquarters, the local headquarters of the Lahousen Wool Company, and they had offices, mm-hmm. stores all over South America, mm-hmm. and that was also the spy network, because General Lahousen was one of the spies down there. But the Etappendienst used that area to bring in all their agents, and it was not only U-boats that went there, but also there were a couple of 90-ton sailing boats that would come in there, because sailboats, being wood back in those days, don't appear on radar.
They don't, yeah, exactly.
So,
That was one of the interesting things about the Horton, that advanced, wonderful twin jet plane, the HO-229. It was wood, composite wood, and it would have had very low radar signature.
And also, Horton used, I think it was crushed charcoal mixed in with the paint to help diffuse the radar images as well.
Just brilliant.
Yeah. And that, if you look at that and you look at our B-2 bomber, you'll You'll see where they got the idea.
Precisely. Do you know the? Do you remember the? Of course you do. I know you, but you folks remember the Northrop flying wing? That came directly from German technology. It was originally propelled by six rear-facing turboprops. And it was quite an amazing airplane. If you look at the film, the original, Invaders from Mars, you'll see it at the end.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that?
When I was a kid, I'm not talking about the movie, talking about the XB-36, which is the one with the six pusher-prop engines.
Yeah.
When I was a kid living in Chicago.
It was a precursor to the B-52.
Right. And also it was followed on by the YB-49, which was jet-powered flying wing. But I was just a kid, and I came out of the house in Chicago, and there's this noise in the air, and I look up, and I knew about every fighter plane bomber there was during the war, and this was about a year after the war. And I look up, and I saw this thing coming over, and I thought, wait a minute, it's missing a fuselage. There's no tail. There's no body.
Uh-huh.
Just a gigantic wing. And then they switched over to the jet engines. That became the YV-49. And one of our members, who's now passed on, was Robert Cardenas, who retired as a brigadier general. He was a test pilot on the YV-49, and he told Jack Northrop that the thing was unstable, and if it started to stall, it would spin backwards.
Huh.
And so he wouldn't fly it anymore, and then the next test pilot wasn't so lucky. He was flying the YB-49, and it
stalled out.
And it spun backwards, and it came down hard. And unfortunately, the pilot was killed with it.
What's really interesting about that aircraft is that the Northrop employees and Jack Northrop believed in it so much that they offered to switch their entire fleet of propeller-driven flying wings to jets at their cost, on their time.
Yeah.
They knew it was going to be a dominant design, and the government said, nope, collected them all, chopped them up, and that was the end of it.
Yeah.
Of course, we know what happened to the program. It went black.
Yeah. Sometimes the government doesn't make a lot of sense in what they do. But when they finally got the YB-49 modified properly, then it was very stable. And now we see the B-2.
Yeah. I wish I had seen. I remember seeing B-36s. Amazing aircraft. I remember seeing 24s and 17s way up high. Silver. They were all aluminum. Just silver.
Yeah,
shiny.
The 36 had four bomb bays in it, and I have to chuckle over that. The 36 was already in and out of service by the time I was in the Air Force, but I was I took 6 months intensive weapons training, and my specialty was thermonuclear weapons, and we had a B-36 fuselage in the hangar that we were using to practice loading with, but there was a long tube that went down the entire length of the plane.
Yeah.
Past the bomb bay, and there was a little crawler, kind of creeper thing in there that you could lay on and
pull yourself along.
Yeah, and so when the sergeant wasn't looking, I'd jump up in there and get on the little creeper and go halfway down there and fall asleep while he was.
Oh,
still
funny. Funny stuff.
And I knew it was time to get back when I'd hear the sergeant yelling, "Where the hell's Cooper?"
Always in trouble.
Yeah.
All right. Well, those are really fun times. Machines, not computers.
Memories.
Yeah. No computers, machines.
That's for sure.
Just amazing things. Okay, the most recent trip that Harry and Shark Hunters went on was the one we're going to talk about in just a few minutes when we come back from our break, a couple of minutes, the Southern Patrol to Europe. And we've got lots of pictures, so we'll take a walk with Harry as we continue. So get your pictures loaded up and get ready. We'll be right back. Okay, and we're back with Harry Cooper of SharkHunters.com. The Southern Patrol. All right, I hope you have photos page number one loaded up. Let's roll into this and see where we go.
Down the road, I guess.
I'd say.
Yeah, the first photo there where it says Ein Laudung, that's the invitation to the memorial service in southern Austria.
Uh-huh.
And where the veterans memorialize and remember anyone who fell in battle, no matter what uniform they were wearing. And
mm-hmm.
without this invitation, you don't get in because they frequently have loony left-wing...
Troublemakers.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
are usually paid. They're young punks that are usually paid to demonstrate in a group called Antifa, which
uh-huh.
means anti-fascist. And they hold up signs, Nazi Rouse, and other signs that say it would have been better if you'd have been killed in the war and never came home. So
I wonder who pays them.
I can't imagine. But, you know, if these people would have jobs, they wouldn't be out there creating trouble. And all these guys, these old guys, all they're doing is remembering their fallen comrades. So that's why they've got some security. Normally it's up on top of a mountain in southern Austria, but we'll get more to that when we get down to there. We start out though, you see that old tower.
Mm-hmm.
That is a 13th century watchtower in Nuremberg. It is also inside, it's a museum, which is not open to the public, but as you know, Eingang Verboten means shark hunters are welcome here.
Exactly.
A lot of people think that means entry forbidden, but we know they're only kidding.
In your case, it means the opposite. Now, this is a 13th century watchtower in Nuremberg.
Right. That's correct.
Now,
in the old wall, and they've got a city wall that's about 5.5 kilometers, and it's not destroyed. It's one of the few old city walls in Europe that is not destroyed, and it's, I think, the longest or the next to the longest unbroken city wall in Germany, 5.5 kilometers.
Goes around the city.
Right. And in the old days, there were apartments in the wall. People lived in the apartments in the wall so that they would have the armed people ready to defend if... the enemy was at the gates, they would have people right there already.
This city wasn't ravaged by British and American bombers like many others, Nuremberg.
Well, no, I'm afraid it was. It was pretty well blown to shreds.
Well, they didn't get this part of it.
No, they missed the tower, but they did pretty much make a mess of the city, and towards the end of the war, there were a lot of planes and a lot of bombs and a lot of people sitting around, and so they just bombed all sorts of stuff, whether it had military significance or not. Nuremberg was one such city, not quite like Dresden, where it was firebombing and deliberately meant to kill hundreds of thousands of civilians, but this one was still pretty much blown to pieces. I think they said about 70% of the city was destroyed.
Wow. Okay.
The important parts are still standing, though.
Now, I guess I saw a story about it once, and I guess they concentrated on the things that weren't blown up, and so,
right.
Well, this is good. All right. Next up.
Okay, then you'll see that old cathedral with the clock tower on it, and the next picture is that tall, gold-looking structure. That's an old water tower in the city center, and that, and then the picture.
That's a water tower.
Yeah,
it's pretty ornate.
It's a fountain, not a water tower. I'm sorry,
oh,
I checked that.
Right.
And it's surrounded by a fence. Very ornate. And there's a long story about the guy who owned the iron company that built the fence around it. He had a young man working for him, and he had a beautiful young daughter, and they fell in love, and he thought the young worker was just trying to marry the daughter so he could inherit the place.
Uh-huh.
So he fired him and told him to get out of town, so the kid did. But before he went, he made a ring about 5 inches in diameter, that he put into this grill work, and the ring was so perfect you couldn't tell where it began and where it ended. There was no steam.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ironmonger wanted to get the guy back, to hire him back, but he was gone. And so that's the old story. So that old cathedral and this water fountain and the dark-looking building, the next picture, those are all at the city square. And if you remember in the movie Triumph of the Will by Leni Riefenstahl, who was also a member of Shark Hunters up until the day she died.
Well, what a nice thing. That's great.
You would see all this in that film as Adolf Hitler came through Nuremberg in his parade, because they went right past all these buildings. Beautiful place, and on the weekends, naturally, like any German town, they have their big fair set up, flea market, farmer's market type thing, and the stands, and all sorts of great things to buy, food, souvenirs, naturally beer.
But you don't like beer anymore.
I never did. I never acquired a taste for it, and back when I was a professional racing driver, my crew called me Half Can Harry. Because if I had half a beer, I'd have a lampshade on my head and be dancing on the tables.
Wow.
So my Irish granddad must roll over in his grave every time I go to Europe, because I did have three beers on this trip. So I'm getting there. There's hope
you
for
had
me
those
yet.
Little 3-ounce cans? Or...
No, these were big glasses.
All right.
Nice, good, freshly brewed German beer.
I'll bet it was root beer.
No, it's the light, lager beer, that's it. See, I know zippity squat about beer. As we were walking through the old town, you see the guy in the red jacket, the lady standing beside him, and that's a didgeridoo he's playing there, an Australian didgeridoo.
Yep.
Now, why you would find an Australian guy in Austria playing the didgeridoo is anybody's guess, and that's his wife. Or girlfriend, whatever, next to him. And
she playing?
She was singing, if you want to call it that. I'm surprised it didn't shatter the glass all around her. It was high-pitched and very loud. But, you know, people were throwing money into his briefcase there. He was making money at it. It was an interesting thing. And for some reason, we find didgeries all through, this is Bavaria, where this is, Nuremberg, and also down in Klagenfurt in southern Austria. There's people playing didgeridoo. God only knows why, but they're making money at it, so they do it.
All right, very good. Hold on, we'll take a break and come right back as we enjoy the pictures and a tour on the Southern Patrol of SharkHunters.com with Harry Cooper. Be back in just a couple. Okay, back with Harry Cooper, and we're on a trip in Germany. All right, let's go back to the pictures, Harry. What's up next? After the didgeridoo, what's next?
Yeah, after the guy with the didgeridoo, and incidentally, if your listeners want to see more pictures, they just go to sharkhunters.com and click on previous tours. The next one, you'll see an old guy with a white beard, and there's a yellow sign behind him, and it says Thomas Verki, Am Schalter. Basically, they're against nuclear power, nuclear weapons, and anything nuclear, they're against it. And so I was reading one of their brochures in German, and they came over and were trying to talk me into a donation. And I told them that I'm not from there; I'm an American. They didn't care. They thought a donation would be a good idea. And then I told them in German that when I was in the Air Force, I was an atomic weapons specialist. They just took the brochure out of my hand and walked away from me. So I don't think they wanted my donation after that. Then we get to the history part, and you'll see the bas relief, or whatever you call that.
Bas relief. Yeah.
Bas relief. That's it. And excuse me. It's on the building that was the headquarters for the magazine called Der Stürmer, The Storm, which was run by Julius Streicher. And he was he fell out of favor with the Nazi Party, the NSDAP, and he had been the Gauleiter, and so he was stripped of his powers and banished from the city, but he was a good buddy of Adolf Hitler, so they couldn't execute him. Well, this was his building, and that bas-relief shows an ancient German knight who couldn't afford clothes, apparently. And if you look closely at the tree, you find two little gremlins peeking around, and he's about to cut the head off the Hydra, which at that time referred to the Jews. He was going to be cutting the head off the Jews. He was wanted after the war was over. I don't know why. All he did was publish a newspaper, but he was wanted, and he was hiding out in the mountains, hiding in plain sight. He would be painting. He was a pretty good artist, I guess, and so he was painting pictures of the mountain scenery, and his biggest customers were the American GIs. And one time, some GIs were watching him paint up on top of a mountain, and one of the guys said, you know, you look a lot like that Julius Streicher that we're looking for. And instead of playing it cool and saying, oh, yeah, I get that all the time, he got all nervous. No, no, I'm not him. And he started sweating and everything. So they hauled him back to Nuremberg, and they found out, yep, that was Streicher, and they hanged him. So, incidentally, they didn't hang him in the normal way of dropping people through all those.
They let him strangle.
They let him strangle. They just hung him up on a hook and watched him dance, which is kind of a harsh way to go.
Yep.
Now we get into the more historical stuff. You see the fellow opening the door. That's letting us into that 13th century tower. That's our friend Michael. He's a lieutenant colonel in the German army. He's a battalion commander, and he's also the aide or assistant, whatever you want to call it, to the mayor of Nuremberg. And he's got all the keys to everything. So we go into the tower museum, and we'll see some of the items in the museum momentarily. But I couldn't help taking that one photograph from up there on the parapet, looking down. You see the houses with the red front on them. Are you with me on that picture?
Yeah.
Okay. That we always have a couple single guys head down for this area.
The red is no accident.
Section. Yeah, that's the red light section.
I got it. Yeah.
So we take that picture, and nobody split off to that on this particular tour, but we walked past it, of course, and had some pleasant comments back and forth to the girls and their gigantic boyfriend. So we just keep your camera put away, because God help you, you take somebody's picture, you're gonna be a real popular fellow with some 6 foot, 280-pound guy. Okay, then you see the building. This is a very historic building. You see with the four big windows?
Got it. You're right there. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's the Palace of Justice, which is what they call it. And those four windows, that is looking into room 600, which is where the Nuremberg Tribunal were held.
Yeah, I figured, yeah.
We used to go in there all the time, because that was an operating courtroom. And our friend Michael would make sure there was no court going on that particular day. We'd go in there, and you could see the door, which was the elevator where they brought the prisoners up from, and everything is pretty much like it was back in those days. But now they've spent a bunch of taxpayer euros and turned it into a museum. Excuse me. Now, we don't go there anymore. We don't mind paying a few bucks to go into the museum, but now it is, how shall I put this? It's kind of like the documentation centers, which are all over Germany. And basically, they just show how horrible the Germans were to certain people. And there are big displays. memorializing certain people, one of them being a guy named Ilya Ehrenberg. You must know that name.
I certainly do.
Okay, he was the Soviet radio broadcaster that, after the Germans had surrendered,
yeah,
he was telling the Soviet...
A madman, maniac, psychopath, yeah, of the first magnitude.
Yep, and he, for days, he was, on the radio shows, he was telling the Soviets that...
Kill.
To kill the German men, even though the war was over, and they're talking about civilians, and also rape as many German women as they could.
Every one of them.
Yep. So so we don't go there anymore.
No.
propaganda, you know.
As you know, Harry, just from our listeners, the Nuremberg trials were a Zionist operation, a Zionist show. They completely penetrated the whole process, set it up, ran it, and Germany has been on its knees ever since. What people don't know is between 1945 and 1953, approximately somewhere between 5 and 8 more million Germans were killed as the Zionists went through Germany and liquidated anybody who was a patriot or remembered all about Germans and Germany. And they wanted to erase all of that, just take their country, take their inhabitants.
They were just executed summarily without, I mean, even the SS soldiers, if they got caught, they were generally just shot right on the Soviets.
It's amazing.
Without taking them to prisoner camp at all, they just shot them.
Yeah. All right, hold on. We'll be right back with Harry in just a couple minutes. Okay, back with Harry, and looking at some real history that many of you have never seen. I haven't, and it's fascinating. All right, next up, we have a display of... go ahead and tell us
what we've
got.
The next thing you'll see is another tower. This tower was built during the war. It was an anti-aircraft bomb shelter. Pointed top, so a bomb couldn't land on it, and the walls were like 3.5 feet thick. And they just run people in there to avoid the bombing. But then after the war, the sign is still visible, painted on the doorway, that says it's off limits to Allied personnel. And that's because when they'd round up the ladies of the night, they'd put them in there to rehabilitate them so they couldn't have the clients coming to call on them.
Really? They could rest.
Yeah, to
teach
them there's other ways to make a living, I guess.
Then
there's a world. This is a museum. It's an incredible museum.
Is this in the tower?
Inside the tower, that's correct. And this is run by our friend Michael. And there's way more photos on the website than what we had room for here. But first you see the picture of that World War One machine gun. Then the next photo we see is with the swastika flag. Now, it is illegal to display a swastika flag full open, but if you fold it in half, like this one, it's okay. Because if anybody was to see that whole swastika, their brain would melt, and so it's against the law.
Their brain would melt, they'd start goose-stepping and everything else.
Yeah, right. Arm in the air.
American military, I don't know, it was a battalion. So anyway, they had the swastika as their logo going into the war. They had to drop it, but that's an old, old symbol. By the way, I don't know if it's still the case, but as of not too many years ago, the company that was making these flags was still making them for collectors all around the world. They never stopped making those flags.
Yeah, that's for sure. And the U.S. Army division you're talking about is the 45th Infantry Division. They had the swastika up until the beginning of the war. And then for obvious reasons, they had to switch. So they took the Navajo Thunderbird for their patch. And it was the 45th Infantry Division that liberated the camp at Dachau, and then took all the guards and stood them against the wall and machine gunned all the German guards, and those who weren't dead from the machine gunning got the .45 caliber in the back of the head. That was the 45th Infantry Division. So moving along, then you see a diorama of a trench warfare.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a uniform on a mannequin. Then you'll see one of our guys there, Hans Spiker. He was in the U-boat service, and he was holding up that uniform that's in the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just happier than a kid with a new toy because he used to wear a uniform exactly like that.
I'll be darned.
Yeah, he's one of the lucky ones because only one out of seven
came
home from the war.
He's looking pretty good for being a U-boat crew member.
Oh, yeah, he's 87, I think, now.
Wow.
And he came with his daughter because he's a widower now, and he's moving in with his daughter and her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And she said all he would do would be to sit in the easy chair all day and watch television, and she couldn't get him moving. And so she signed him and her up for this patrol, and she said, took 10 years off his life. He was walking, he was drinking his beer, he was talking to old veterans over there, and it was a new lease on life for him. He was a great guy. He's a lot of fun. He lives in the U.S. He emigrated here in the 1950s. So the next picture, you'll see that old building with a golden starburst. And then the next building is inside, or the next photo is inside that building. Now, that is a restaurant, and it was in operation 90 years before Christopher Columbus left Europe to come to the Americas. It started in, I think, 1417 or something like that. And they only serve one thing. You'll see the dish I took a photo of. Those are the Nuremberg sausages, and they're not much bigger than your little finger.
Mm.
They're really good, but they're really rich.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they're so small is because when the king would come to town, the castle was on the hill there at Nuremberg, and
sure.
There was no furniture in the castle and no cooking utensils and no food, so the people in town had to bring furniture up, beds, tables, chairs, and loan them to the king, and they also had to furnish a certain number of sausages at their own expense, of course, because it's good to be the king.
Mm-hmm.
And so they made these little dinky sausages, and that's my plate there. You get them in groups of six, and that's all I could finish.
You ate the whole thing.
Say again?
You cleaned the plate.
Yeah, oh, yeah, and that German potato salad with it. Oh, man, it's good. And you notice there's a beer sitting there. That's one of my three beers I had.
Half gone. That fits the profile. Half
yeah, that,
can
that kills it.
So those are not scrambled eggs.
No, that's a German potato salad.
Oh.
And it is wonderful. And we have a standing contest with Shark Hunter members. Anybody who can beat the previous record number of sausages, I'll pay for their dinner. Well, it hasn't been broken for some years. One of our guys, a guy named Steve Rhea, an iron worker from Detroit, he ate 42 of these things and then topped it off with a gigantic ice cream sundae. So he holds the record right now.
42 of those finger sausages?
Yeah.
And he didn't vomit?
No, he had a big ice cream sundae after that. He's a big guy.
Yeah.
So,
that's amazing.
But, the all-time record is held by some guy who lives in Germany. He's a little skinny guy. He ate 130-something of them, I guess. So, geez.
No.
Okay,
no.
Now we're getting into some heavy history now. You'll see that it's a picture of an Elvis impersonator poster where it's torn and there's a yellow arrow.
Sure.
Okay, that's on a small building just on the street. It looks kind of like it might be an electrical box or electrical structure where you go in to repair electrical wires or something. The thing is only about 8 feet wide by about 12 feet long, and that's it. It's just doesn't look like anything. But you peel back that little poster, and the arrow is pointing at a keyhole. You stick a key in there, open the door, and you go into the now abandoned bunker system underneath Nuremberg.
Oh.
It was a huge, massive air raid shelter.
Uh-huh.
And the first one we went into was built to hold about 6,000 people during the air raid. We went through that, and then we went through another section that held about four times as many, and this is strictly off limits. We were in it a year ago, and the plan then was to fill it with sand. And I thought at the, now I'm no engineer, but I thought at the time, how the hell are you going to fill something like this, which is huge, massive underground? How are you going to fill it up with sand and get it compacted? Well, the city of Nuremberg talked to some engineers, and they said, it's not possible. You can't fill it up with sand, because by the time you start at the back end, by the time you get to the front, the sand has settled, and now there's a gap of about 6 inches from the ceiling to the sand, and how are you going to refill that when you're, you know,
stupid thinking.
Yeah. So they decided, okay, we'll just shut off the electrical power so there's no lights and nobody's allowed down there. But we went down there with our flashlights, and the next three photos, you just see scenes of us. We're about 600 feet underneath the city of Nuremberg.
600 feet deep?
Yeah.
How did you get down that deep?
Well, you go downstairs.
That's a hell of a lot of stairs.
Yep. Well, there's a lot of bombs falling on people's head. They wanted to make
600
sure
feet deep, they built that?
Yeah.
And they excavated the material and brought it up out of there?
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
They had several entrances and exits, all of which are locked now. There's another one right in the basement of City Hall. make sure there's a way for the City Hall people to get down there.
Yeah. Did you tear that poster open to get to that keyhole?
Yeah.
It looks like a new Harry Cooper tear.
No, I wouldn't do anything like
I'm
that.
I'm kidding. Of course.
And then you see one picture of some paperwork. They just walked away from the place. There's paperwork down there. There's equipment down there. And they just walked away and left it.
Vertical pipes were water, air, stuff like that?
Yeah, ventilation. And
unreal.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Then the next sign you'll see, Betreten Verboten.
Mm-hmm.
That means don't come in there. And then the other word, Steinschlaggefahr, means warning, you're going to get hit on the head with falling rocks, basically. And the big ominous-looking structure, that's the backside, that's the backside of the Zeppelin Field stadium, you know, where Hitler used to come out on the other side, the front side.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and this is the backside. And he would come to a train station about 100 meters from this stadium, and you'll see that train station in a few minutes, because that's where we have our lunch there. It's a great restaurant. But then he'd come in the door in the back, which the next picture you see, that gigantic door, that's where he would come in, into the Golden Room. And you'll see the photo of the ceiling of the Golden Room there.
Okay, we got to go to photos number two.
Okay.
Okay, there's the door.
Right.
All right.
And we go in that door, and again, that's off limits. And the Golden Room you see in there, the ceiling is all inlaid with golden images, including the swastikas are all still in the ceiling.
I see them. Yeah.
And another photo right after that one, similar fancy scroll work swastikas. They're still there.
Stylized.
The law has been passed in Germany that anything built during the days of the Reich cannot be destroyed anymore, but must be maintained.
Well, thank goodness. It's just a piece of history. Come on.
Yeah, but unfortunately, this they're going to take care of, I'm sure. It requires 70 million euros, which is about 90 million Yankee dollars, to just maintain this place, and nobody knows where they're getting this money.
Well,
but a lot of the other buildings, the smaller, lesser important buildings, but are, you know, historical, they're not allowed to tear them down, so they just abandon them, and they open them and let vandals come in.
Let the bums and vandals in. All right.
Make a mess of the place.
I got it.
And then they'll say, well, you know, it's unsafe. We have to tear it down.
I understand.
So.
I got the tricks.
Yeah.
Hold on right there, Harry. We have to pause. We'll come right back. On our tour with Harry Cooper in just a couple minutes. Okay, right back to our picture tour with Harry Cooper, sharkhunters.com, and the recent Southern Patrol to Europe, Germany. Okay, we are looking at an empty building with some three signboards up against the walls.
Right. That's, incidentally, this is not just Harry Cooper going to places like this. This is all our members who go with us on the tours.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody could go if there was a Shark Hunters group. This room you're looking at with the three signboards, that was Hitler's personal office inside the stadium at Nuremberg. It's kind of empty now. It's used as a storage place. Then the next photo, you see our friend Hans Spiker standing at the very place where Hitler used to stand to deliver his speeches.
Huh.
We caution our people now that the older guys, there's no problem, but the younger guys get a little carried away, and we caution them, don't stick your right arm in the air because it'll cost you 2,500 euros if you do.
They got a camera on there too, right?
Oh, and they got cops in the area.
Yeah, there's the graffiti on the front.
Yeah, they take it very seriously, whether it's right, wrong, or otherwise. That's mm-hmm. the law. You don't have any way out of it. If you do it, you're gonna get hit for 2,500 euros.
What if you hold your left arm on?
Well, I don't think there's a problem with the left arm, but the right arm, which, you know, that always drives me nuts. They call it the Nazi salute. It is not. It's the Roman salute. It's to show that your right hand.
Of course, it goes way back. Yeah.
Right. You have no weapon. You're an honorable man. Yep, you have no weapon. Yep. That's what that arm in the air is to show. But that's their law, so unless you got 2,500 bucks, you don't mind kissing off. Then you see that old brick building there. It's mm-hmm. a huge place. It's called mm-hmm. the Congress Hall,
mm-hmm.
properly pronounced Congressahalle. This was never finished, but it was going to house all the party officials in the area. And it's built like the Colosseum in Rome, and that black and white photo right after that is what it would have looked like if when it was finished. And it was going to have a glass dome over the top of the place. It was huge. I think they said you could put the Colosseum in there four times over.
That was one of the grand designs of Albert Speer.
Yep.
To make Germany. I mean, the buildings that were going to be built were just incredible in scope. And statement and vision, just remarkable.
Yeah, and kind of a negative thing, toward the end of the war, the Congress Hall was being used as a makeshift hospital for wounded German troops.
Yeah.
And when the U.S. forces took over Nuremberg, they found that 17 of these wounded soldiers were Waffen-SS, and the U.S. Army hauled these guys out into the courtyard where we're standing and shot them dead.
You know, the Waffen-SS is probably the most misunderstood term of the war. These were elite troops.
Yep.
They weren't some kind of psychopathic mass murderers. They were the best of the best in some ways.
They were the best of the best.
And they kicked the crap out of virtually everyone that they opposed. They didn't care if they were outnumbered. Didn't matter.
They didn't know how to quit.
No.
And any of the military that fought against them will be the first ones to say they were tough as nails. It just and when we get down to southern Austria to this memorial, you'll see most of the veterans we meet down there are former Waffen-SS.
Huh.
The great guys. The next picture shows kind of a ramp going up. That was in the old style to bring people up, carriages first and then cars, because this was at the far side of the Congress Hall. And the doorway, that was Hitler's personal doorway. Only Hitler could come in and out of that place. So they're keeping it for, I guess they use it for the city of Nuremberg. Then you see a red brick building. That was the headquarters and the Stützpunkt, the barracks, etc., of the 1st SS, the Leibstandarte Adolf Hitler, which was the best of the best. It is now headquarters of the immigration department where they're helping all these so-called asylum seekers come into Germany and get welfare.
Bringing the Africans and the Muslims and other Eastern European riffraff.
A lot of Turks.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, it's a globalist plan to destroy the individual uniqueness of every country, take its personal pride, its history down.
Yeah, they keep praising this diversity.
No.
Yeah, I know. The college my daughter went to for her first 2 years, it was a smaller local college before she got into a university for the third and fourth year. They had signs all over the place praising diversity.
Well,
yeah. Okay.
Brainwashed.
Moving along on that one.
Chancellor Merkel, I think, no, it wasn't Merkel, it was one of the big Deutsche Bank guys, said the so-called diversity, cultural diversity does not work.
Right. And I think the Dutch, if I remember reading the news flashes correctly, they're pulling back out of it.
Well, it's either that or lose their identity.
Right. And that's basically what the overall design is, lose the identity. The next memorial you'll see with the big eagle on top of it, that's the memorial to the Luftwaffe. And the only reason that wasn't destroyed is because it was originally a memorial to the World War I flyboys.
Huh.
And so then they added the World War II stuff. But if you build a you can't build a memorial to the World War II anything over there. It's against the law. And,
we should make it clear that this is not really German law. These laws were put in place by people who were outside the sphere of Germany itself, who came in after the war and took it over.
Yeah, the German government.
It's not the government of the people.
Right.
No.
And I've been told, I don't know if this is really true or not, but I think it is true, but the countries that have red passports are referred to as captive nations, whereas other people that have blue passports, like we do in the U.S., were allegedly a free nation. So, read into whatever you like.
Right.
Then you see the structure with all those vertical openings. That's where they would have the, what's called the death ceremony during the big shindigs at Nuremberg on Zeppelinfeld. This is at the clear opposite end from the stadium. And you've seen if you saw the movie Triumph of the Will, or if you saw some of the posters, you see hundreds of thousands of troops standing at attention, and Hitler flanked by Himmler, and then the guy who replaced Rome with the SA, they would march the whole way to this structure, and they would have huge, big braziers with flames coming out of it to have a ceremony to honor the fallen.
Huh.
And it's still there, but and you can't tear it down, but they're not doing anything to boost it again either.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to stay like that, I guess, forever. Then we have two pictures. One's a doorway. The other's a bunch of suitcases.
Those are very impressive.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. This is what's called Hitler's train station. This is the train mm-hmm. station where Hitler would get off the train behind the stadium at Zeppelinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
So he could come in unseen, and he would always wait. He'd be 15, 20, 30 minutes late before he made his appearance from the highest doorway there at the stadium. But this mm-hmm. is a restaurant now, and it's made to look like the old days with the suitcases up on the rack. And if you go down the hallway, it's the same hallway that was there in the 1930s. And undoubtedly, Hitler walked down that hallway along with all the rest of the people. So, you know, when you go with shark hunters, you're walking in the footsteps of history.
Yeah.
We're traveling in the time tunnel, I guess, of history.
That's amazing.
If you let your imagination run wild, you can almost hear the people around you.
Yeah, I believe it.
Then we say goodbye to Nuremberg, and we start heading south for the really the biggest reason why we come there is for the memorial. And you'll notice that castle, it's privately owned. Obviously, somebody in Austria has a ton of money because it's privately owned. This is the castle that was used in the movie Where Eagles Dare. So the Austrian government had enough sense to, this castle has been there forever, and the Autobahn goes right past. They had enough sense to build a little runoff road off the Autobahn for a scenic overlook so people could get out and take pictures, which is what we did. Now you don't have it here on your photo array, but on the website there's more photos of just how incredibly beautiful it is driving through the Austrian Alps. And we get down to the southernmost county, if you want to call it that. It's called a Kreis, of Kärnten. This is where the ceremonies are held. This is where all the festivities are, etc. And you'll see the picture of the breakfast room there. That's our hotel to show, you know, viewers what a nice place we stay. Then the next photo, you see our friend Hans Spiker,
mm-hmm.
with two of the other veterans we know who live in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't, you know, we introduced them, and it wasn't long before they were trading old war stories, and literally within 5 minutes, there were tears running down Hans's face.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Remembering the old days.
Yeah.
Then we take off on our boat trip that's on the Werthersee, which is a beautiful alpine lake. I think it's about 15 kilometers long. Don't hold me to that. But it's a three-hour tour, not with Gilligan and the skipper, but on one of these boats.
Mm-hmm.
Where they got refreshments, and Hans Spiker got himself a banana split, which was big enough for about three people. And, of course, there was beer to be had, so I'm told. I don't drink beer, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a beautiful tour all around that lake, and there's about a dozen or two pictures on the website. Just it looks like a tour through a fairyland. The old structures, the old
sure.
hotels, and the
church. I can understand. Yeah,
it's gorgeous. And then after that, then we start our evenings with the veterans. You see the picture of the lady with the white hair and the fellow in the center.
Yeah.
And then the guy on the right, I have no idea who he is. But the fellow in the center, another one of our members, Manfred Thorn, he was with the 1st SS. He was with Piper during the Malmedy situation.
Oh, yeah.
And he explained that the line of march was 20 miles long. What was happening in one little area, the rest of the people had no idea what was going on. So he had to stand trial for the Malmedy massacre, as it's called, as did a whole lot of people. And he was found not guilty of anything because he wasn't anywhere near it. And he has put his memoirs down, and his wife, that lady next to him, who's a Brit, British lady, she's translated it. And it's an excellent book. We're trying to help her get it published.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, getting a regular publisher to take a book by a German that holds German soldiers in a good light, not an easy job, but we're working on it. And you'll notice there's a lot of beer at those tables, too.
Looks like there's a plaque or something in front of her. I don't know what that is. A scrapbook or something?
Yeah, I don't remember what it was. Yeah, it was awarded that evening. They award a lot of plaques to a lot of the veterans. I don't remember what it was. Maybe I had a beer that night.
No. Maybe you did. It's it's important to point out again that these veterans, I think only 1 out of 10 in the military were actually members of the party. These were patriots. These were Germans defending their country. And
right.
A veteran is a veteran is a veteran.
Yeah, in the German Navy, the Kriegsmarine, they were not allowed to belong to any party. And the sad thing now, I'm an American veteran, so I belong to the American Legion. I never go there because I'm too busy running shark hunters. But any of the Legion posts or the VFW posts, they've got a their own building, and they fly their flag and the MIA flag, and they've got our local post has a Huey helicopter out front, or they'll have a field gun or something. Mm-hmm. They can't do that in Germany. The next photo you see, a bunch of people sitting, plaques all along the wall. That's their version of the Legion Hall, the Navy group of that area. They're meeting in that room. They got a couple rooms. It's a mm-hmm. former coal bin in the basement of a hotel. They can't put a flag outside. They can't make a big fuss about it. They got a little brass plaque on the doorway to show that that's where they're at, but that's it. They can't meet in public. I mean, they're not
out of sight, out of mind. I understand. They gotta be.
And then the next photo, that's me on the right, and the fellow on the left is Karl Heinz Fismer. He's the president of the Marina Kameradschaft, and they presented me with that plaque, me, shark hunters, with that plaque, because
nice.
We bring so many people there so much. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more photos on the website of that facility, and it's just fantastic. And how we crowd so many people into that fairly small place is going to have to shoehorn us in.
All right. Photos number three. We'll move over to page three now.
Okay. That's the one with four guys and one guy standing there with a beer, right? Boy, they got beer for everything. From the left, that's me. The guy in the blue shirt, he's Austrian-born, but he's Australian, and he's in the Australian Coast Guard, Ernst Priegel. The next guy is a good friend of mine, Paul Roche.
In the background?
No, in the background.
Okay.
That's Peter. He's a doctor of law, and he's a nice guy, but he can put you to sleep when he talks. Oh, he's got a deep baritone voice, and he talks so slowly, and he's got 1,000 words on every subject. Nice guy, though. As a matter of fact, when we were the next day, when we were at the memorial, we were inside this huge, huge field tent, and I was in my wool winter uniform, and it was hotter than hell. He was sitting next to me, and on my left, and on my right were more guys in their winter uniforms, all wool, and it was hot. He gave me a little nudge with his elbow. He said, "Would you like some special Corinthian medicine?" Okay, yeah. Pulls out his hip flask, and it's all full of schnapps.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're passing it up and down the line, having our snort of schnapps. He's a nice guy. The next guy, though, the one with the beer bottle right in front of him, that's Paul Roche. He was 5th SS. He was a tank commander, held the rank of Oberleutnant. And then he got wounded badly in battle, and so they made him a forward observer. And the next photo was that evening. That's me with Paul Roche again. Fun guy. I went over to visit him a couple of years ago. He was 90 at the time. He's 94 now.
Wow.
I think they patterned the Energizer Bunny after this guy.
Well, that or the beer, one of the
yeah,
other.
Yeah, it must be. But I went to visit him a few years ago. He was, like I say, he was 90. And I'm in really good shape for an old guy. I couldn't keep up with this guy. He was walking. I had to literally run to keep up with him. This was during Christmas time. I went over to visit a bunch of people for Weihnachtsfest. And this guy just never quit. He was a widower. And these two old ladies came running out, Polly, oh, look, Harry, we have these two beautiful young ladies, and one grabbed onto my arm, and I'm thinking, my God, this is my grandmother here. So, but he's 100 miles an hour, that guy. God bless him.
Yeah.
He wants to come to visit the United States, but because he was in the SS, He can't get a visa. They won't let him into the United States because he was a member of a criminal organization, the SS. Right. What can I say?
Not much more.
No. Then the next photo is the beginning of the memorial ceremony on the mountain, although it wasn't on the mountain this time for political reasons, I guess. Wealthy guy bought the whole mountain. And on the top, there's a ruined church and a gigantic cross where they've had their meetings almost every year. The guy who bought the mountain said, yeah, you can use the facility, no problem, but you can't use the road to get there because it's in terrible shape. And he's arguing with the city. The city says it's his property, he should fix the road. And he says, no, it's a city road, you should fix it. So we were down at the foot of the mountain. And that's me in my winter uniform there, Coast Guard auxiliary. I'm no longer in it, but I was a flotilla commander at the time. And I'm with, trying to remember this guy's whole name, a friend of mine, Eric. But it's General Lieutenant Erich Sporus von Reisenau, and he's got about 16 titles behind that. He's the naval attaché for Sweden. And all those buttons, he's got memorial buttons for every place. You see on his jacket, I kid him, asking me, he was trying to do a do-it-yourself bulletproof vest out of that. But then we get into the area where they're having the memorial, and naturally they've got the beer tent set up outside.
Uh-huh.
And there was a film crew. And you look inside, and there you see all the greenery and the ribbons, that remembering all the guys that fell.
Yeah.
And as long as you don't have one that has SS on it. I remember a couple of years ago, some of the SS guys brought this big, huge wreath for the SS, and the police came along with their scissors and cut off the ribbons that showed the SS. The cops gets kind of stupid too, but that's what they're there for.
All right. Hold on a second. We got to do a little business here again. We'll come back.
Some more product.
Yeah, we don't. We don't get on the air for free here. It costs.
Yeah.
The idea that so much is going on over there. There's some fascinating pictures ahead. We have another page of pictures. We'll try and get through all these in the next half an hour with Harry, so don't go away. Okay, let's get back to our picture tour with Harry Cooper. Okay, Harry, we are at the ceremony.
Right, and it lasted for a couple hours. Various speeches made by many right-thinking people, sorry. And the soldiers now are starting to get a little more outspoken. It's kind of late in life,
I guess. It's time for them. If they're going to do it, it's time.
And they want to see a memorial, a World War II memorial to their own soldiers over
there. Absolutely, of course. Why not?
I agree. Sure. I think it's the right thing to do, but it's such an uphill climb because the German federal law strictly prohibits it, so you're going to have to change the law.
The German Zionist federal law.
Well,
I said it, you didn't.
Whoever's law it is, then you got to change it, otherwise it can't happen. Then we see the picture of the people facing the camera, the three guys in the background. The first two are Italian admirals. The guy in a white hat is our friend, the Australian Ernst Prugel. And the fella closer to us looking down, that's the mayor of Reggio Puglia, Italy. And Reggio Puglia is the site of a very, very major World War I battle, where the Austrians were fighting the Italians, and young Oberleutnant Erwin Rommel earned his Blue Max in that battle.
Hmm.
And the blonde hair in the foreground, that's the mayor's young wife. She's a little hottie. She's really cute. A couple of the old veterans spent a lot of time talking to the mayor's wife.
Hmm.
Good to see that the fire hasn't gone out. Then there's a bunch of the standards from the various towns, the various military veterans association, et cetera.
Right.
And then we, that's the end of the memorial. That actually goes for a whole morning. Then we go back outside. There's no photos of this, but then they've got the beer tent and the tent where they're selling different kinds of sausages, the Wurst tent and barbecued chicken. And everybody just sits down at picnic tables out under the open sky and have a great lunch together, and everybody is friends with one another, and old friends see each other again from last year. New friendships are being made. It just, you can't describe it. It's just incredible. And we have guys who are on the tour. This is the fifth time in a row they've come with us. So obviously, it's one hell of a great time. It's
Got
hard
it.
To describe, but it's,
I get the feeling back there. I hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, then we do some sightseeing and some historic places, but. You see that little structure there? That's I lost the word. It's a little shrine.
Okay.
And these shrines are all over Bavaria and Austria, at every major intersection out in the rural areas and in the big cities. These were supposed to be godless Nazis, remember, and yet they had these little shrines everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
The next picture is the side of a mountain with a bit of a castle peeking up over the top.
Okay.
That is the castle Hochsterwitz, which was built back in the 1600s, I think. Was never taken in battle. You can see why. The red circle is that little tiny thing in the red circle is a cable car that holds seven people. And we went up there, as we do every year. We visit the castle. We tour the castle on our own.
You went up in that thing? It looks like it's horizontal to horizontal and sticking out. Or is it pointed downward there?
No, we were going uphill there.
It looks crooked on its rail.
It has a rail. It's a monorail, but it's not a big monorail.
Uh-huh.
You could use both hands and cup it around this monorail, and this car sits on top of it. I have no idea why the damn car doesn't fall over.
And it's
but
a strange
it's
one.
It's just clickety-clickety, and they now have a sign in there in many languages saying you're not supposed to rock the cable car.
I guess, yeah.
And they used to be able to carry eight people, but now they've backed it off to only seven people. But they've never had a problem. So, and you're looking out the windows and you're seeing the ground getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And one time we were there, the cable car was out of service, so we had to walk it all the way. Oh my God.
Is the whole building on top, is that mountain it's on pretty well rock all the way around like that?
It is. It is.
Yeah.
And there's only one path going up, and there are 16 fortified gates on the way up, so you can see why it was never taken in battle.
Yeah.
And this whole mountain with this castle was owned, or is still owned, by the guy who used to own the mountain where they had the memorial on, but he sold that mountain and now still owns this mountain. How much money can you have when you own mountains with castles?
That's wild. Yeah.
So the next picture with the reddish walls and the paintings, that's in the uppermost room in the castle. This is where the knights used to eat. And so this is where shark hunters eat. And you can see that's my Schweinebraten you're looking at there.
Mm-hmm.
And two giant dumplings.
How do they get supplies and things up and down the mountain? And that cable car?
No, they had an earlier cable car. Well, now they had a cable car before, which was seriously state-of-the-art for the 18th century, and they would winch it up, and that's how they still use it today to get the supplies up there, not the people.
No.
They've got an electric motor now, and it's winched up, but it don't look even half as safe as the one that the people ride on.
Yeah.
So, and you're about half a mile in the sky. It's a
long amazing
way.
Place, yeah.
Yeah, you're so high you could darn near see Cleveland from up there.
All right. We're going to go through this break and try and get our rest of our pictures in, so let's go ahead.
Yes, sir.
There's a dragon here.
Yep.
Drooling into a trough.
Yeah, that is the emblem of the city of Klagenfurt, which is the capital city of Carinthia. And the locals tell you that that dragon at one time was alive. It roamed all through Europe back in the 15th and 16th century.
Looks like it to me.
Yeah, it looks alive. And he roamed all through Europe, but he could only eat virgins. And when he got to Klagenfurt, the poor thing just starved to death.
That's the myth.
That's the myth. And the story goes that if a virgin walks past the stone dragon, his tail will wag, and nobody has seen it wag in living history.
Let's see.
But that's right in the plaza downtown.
All right. Next up.
Go ahead.
Next up looks like a sauna.
Yeah, after we leave Austria, we go up to Berchtesgaden, which is an incredibly beautiful town. It looks like it fell off a picture postcard. And the hotel we use now in that area, it has a sauna and steam bath, et cetera, et cetera. And the next photo, you see the bed. When you walk into your room, the bed is turned down. You've got a couple pieces of candy, and you've got a rose on your bed. And the next photo is the breakfast room as you're looking out.
Beautiful.
Beautiful, beautiful place. This is our new home in Berchtesgaden.
This is an historic building.
Oh, it is indeed. It's been there for centuries, and there's a tunnel right next to it that was a hardened railway tunnel, and Hermann Göring had his train full of art treasures in that hardened tunnel, awaiting him to where he could run off to Austria with all his treasures at the end of the war, but it didn't work out for him.
No.
The next, you see this old hotel. This is down by the Königssee, and that hotel had been the headquarters of General Kesselring during the war. Kesselring was a Luftwaffe general, I guess. The next three photos, that's St. Bartholomew's Church out on the Königssee. The next one is the mountains called the Wachmann. There was allegedly an evil king or baron by the name of Wachmann, and his wife and his children were all evil, mean people, and so the gods came down and turned them into mountains. And so now you can see the Wachmann Mountains. Watchman Mountains. Then there's the waterfall coming out the side of the cliff there. The next two items are the breakfast spread at our new hotel, and that doesn't do it justice. There are tables and backboards and everything full of food, and the place is just absolutely magnificent, and it's about 5 minutes walk from right downtown Berchtesgaden.
Wow.
We're in the cemetery, in the town cemetery, right at the very front row is the grave of Dietrich Eckart, the founder of the NSDAP. A lot of people think Hitler founded the party, but he did not. He was number seven, and Dietrich Eckart was the number one guy. Incidentally, they built a beautiful hospital in that town called the Dietrich Eckart Clinic during the Reich. After the surrender of Germany, it was off limits because it was named for a bad guy. And when we would go there, you couldn't get in. Even me, with my lock-picking skills, I couldn't get in because it was locked up, everything was locked, and it was surrounded by a fence that was locked, and you just couldn't get in. Well, now they've taken down the fence, and they've unlocked the door, and vandals are getting in there and destroying it.
Oh, sad. They're going to tear it down eventually.
Yeah, they'll let it get so far. the same happened to the big house Gross Admiral Dönitz had outside of Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
When we were there 5 or 6 years ago, it was in perfect condition, and there was a real estate agent there showing it to some prospective buyers. But then the government took it over, left it open. And normally when you see where kids are going, the teenagers, they go in to have their drinking parties, and they've got their little mattress for their girlfriends and stuff. But you always see the remains of a little fire on the stone floor where they have a little bonfire and they cook their food and they drink their whatever.
Mm-hmm.
These places, you're not seeing that. So it's obviously not kids breaking into houses.
Yeah, it's organized.
It's vandals coming in to destroy.
Yeah.
And when it gets to a certain point, they'll say, well, it's dangerous and it's beyond repair, so goodbye.
That's their technique. Shame. That's how they're doing it.
Yeah. Where there's a will, there's a way, I guess, but bad or otherwise.
Okay, so we got the Hotel Bavaria here and a tunnel next to it.
That's our new hotel.
Uh-huh.
And the guy and his wife who own it are just lovely people. And the tunnel, that's the tunnel I told you about where Goering had his train hidden out.
So there were tracks coming out of that place.
There were tracks, that's correct. That was a rail line.
Mm-hmm.
But after a certain time after the war, it was the rail lines were torn up and it was paved over. And at the dead end into the tunnel, if you look closely, you'll see barricades across there, iron grill work.
Sure, I see them.
The city of Berchtesgaden uses that to park their trucks and backhoes and diggers and stuff in there.
Mm-hmm. And the lit tunnel underneath that with the lights?
That's a different tunnel. That is the Eagle's Nest, originally called Kelstein House. And you after you ride a bus, it goes almost vertically up the side of a mountain, especially geared bus.
Huh.
And they're doing about 900 miles an hour up all these switchbacks. And you get to the top of the mountain. You go down this long tunnel, which you see here.
In the bus?
No, the bus stops and you get
out.
Okay,
you walk.
Yeah,
right.
You walk about, I think it's about 400 feet down this tunnel. It's the same tunnel Hitler and everybody else walked down because that was left over.
Every time he went up to the Eagle's Nest, he went through that tunnel.
Absolutely. It's the only way to get there.
Okay, and the Eagle's Nest is the amazing building at the top where they had all the party dinners and entertainment.
Yeah.
Where a lot of the footage was taken out on the balcony with dignitaries and so forth.
The
Eagle's Nest was blown up. Is that picture the next picture looking up at where the Eagle's Nest was situated?
No, the Eagle's Nest was not blown up. The Eagle's Nest was left alone. Everything else was blown up. Hitler's home, the tea house was blown up.
That's what I'm thinking of. Right.
The Eagle's Nest, even though it was built by Martin Bormann's orders for Hitler's 50th anniversary or birthday, it was not Nazi because they're making so damn much money. You ride up in the same beautiful bronze inlaid elevator that they all rode up in back in those days, and you can carry, I think, 40 people in the elevator, and you pay 17 euros, which is about 20, 21 bucks Yankee money, per person, times 40 people in that elevator. It goes up.
I see.
And it comes down 1 minute later and brings up another 40 people at 20 Yankee dollars each.
That's amazing, huh?
Everybody who goes up there has dinner up there, lunch up there. They have beer up there. They have blue vine.
Yeah.
And each person is worth probably 50, 60 bucks. So it's not Nazi.
Money overrides political consideration. Okay.
Yeah, it do indeed.
Now, the dinner setting is in where?
It's in the main room. Of the Eagle's Nest.
And that's where they all met.
Yep. And I don't have a photo of it here in this array, but there's a huge big fireplace made of red Italian marble, which was a gift from Mussolini.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've got it fenced off. Used to be you could come right up and sit down on the hearth and get your picture taken there, but they've got it fenced off so you can stand in front of it, but you can't sit down on the hearth. And we go there. We have
It's amazing that so many people eat in the same place that was the elite of the elite on the other side were there. That was
That's
it.
Right. And this was a very strange weather, as you'll see there. Everything's covered with snow. And further up at the back of that photo, in the background, there's a cross up on a higher point.
Uh-huh.
Normally, we walk up to there. It's a memorial cross. But if you know where to look, you can also see the foundations for the anti-aircraft guns that were mounted up there. And that was under the command of Dr. Bernhard Frank, who was a member of Shark Hunters until he died. But the weather was so crazy, the wind was coming across, and you'll notice it's a very narrow strip of land, and the wind was coming across at about 60 to 70 miles an hour. And if you got blown, you know, 10 feet, 15 feet off the path, it was about 3,000 feet straight down, so nobody was going out there.
Yeah.
It was really weird weather.
It is.
It must be that global warming, all that snow.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So, and then the last picture is just our group in there having a great meal, wishing we could get outside.
There's one other picture below that. Is that a concrete wall with a door into a mountainside?
Yeah, I'm sorry. That is Hitler's personal escape door. This is not there by the Eagle's Nest. This is on the next mountain over, on the Obersalzberg, right by where his home stood, the Berghof. That whole mountain is honeycombed with tunnels. And the tunnel and air raid bunker system underneath his home led out that door, which, of course, you're not, nobody's allowed to go in there.
Except shark hunters.
Well, sometimes we manage.
Uh-huh.
But, if you go in there, your brain might melt.
Of course.
And you come out goose-stepping. But,
That's right.
And if you stand in front of that door, there's holes drilled in the door about half-inch diameter. I don't know why, but, excuse me, there's always a breeze coming out. There's air coming out those holes.
Huh.
So obviously there's air getting in there.
Somebody engineered it just right.
Oh, yeah, the technology was incredible from what the Reich had built. It was just incredible what they built. And we go there every year. And any of your listeners want information about it, they can go to the website, sharkhunters.com, or send us an email, sharkhunters@earthlink.net. And we walk in the footsteps of history. We take all the photos we want. There's no problem with photos and videos. And we meet all these great veterans, and you're walking in the footsteps of history.
Indeed. The Berchtesgaden was blown, along with the tea house. Wreckage of the Berchtesgaden, are there still bricks there?
There's the Berghof, you mean?
Sorry, the Berghof.
Yeah, there's still bricks there, and our people always pick up bricks. We go up there, and there's nothing left of the Berghof, which was Hitler's home. But the retaining wall is still there. You know, they built a big, strong...
Yeah, sure.
If you know where to look, you can find little openings where there had been windows down into the basement.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're really skinny and if you're really adventurous...
Like shark hunters.
you can get in those little openings and get down into the basement.
Wow.
And there's other places there. There's other tunnels we have found. And, of course, there's the one called the Deep Tunnel, which is about 8 feet high and 8 feet wide. And it goes straight into the mountain for a half a mile, makes a zig to the right, goes another half a mile, and then stops because the war ended and they stopped digging. But to get there, you really have to want to go there. And,
what was it going to come out on the other side? Obviously,
it was going to come out in Austria.
Oh,
so if Germany surrendered, Austria would be clear. That was their thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't work. And there are still holes, blast holes, drilled in the wall where you slide in the dynamite. And some of these blast holes still have the dynamite in there.
How fascinating.
Yeah,
I just
but
stopped.
To get there, I mean, you got to walk about a mile through the woods.
Yeah.
And you have to know where you're going. And after a while, the trail is only literally about 1 foot wide. And when you get to the point where you think there just is no more trail, you look to your right and bang, this huge big door open, this doorway opens up and bang, you go in there. You got to have lights. But, you know, we, like typical Americans, when there's a sign that says this is forbidden, typical Americans want to know why.
You bet.
Well, and so we go in and...
You guys are amazing, and this was the most recent tour.
Yep.
To remind them, Harry, we just have a minute or so left about the one coming up to Argentina in January.
Yeah. The details on that are on the website also. You go there, and not on previous tours, but there's a big white block on the main page that says fascinating tours or something like that. We've got quite a guy building the website, uses a lot of words. But we're going to Argentina, and even I was surprised at all the guys from the Reich that had moved to Argentina after the war. We spend 1 week in Buenos Aires, which is a beautiful, beautiful city, old world charm with modern conveniences. And we go, we'll see the homes where guys lived in, like, Adolf Galland, the fighter general, and Rudel, the greatest pilot probably ever, and Bombach. Some of the top Luftwaffe guys went to Argentina after the war and rebuilt their air force. And we visit the homes where Mengele used to live and Eichmann. And we'll have dinner in the restaurant where Mengele and Eichmann used to meet to have dinner. And many, many other places. There's one we'll visit with the niece of this fella. He was a German Jew. And he got thrown into Dachau, and somehow he got into a fight, and he lost the sight of one eye. After the war was over, he went to South America, to Buenos Aires, and he saw that Israel was offering a reward for this guy named Adolf Eichmann. And his daughter came home and said, oh, there's a young boy named Eichmann in my class. So the guy looked into it, and sure enough, that was the son of Adolf Eichmann. He turned him into Israel. They came and grabbed him.
Yep.
And then he went to the Israel consulate and said, I'm here to pick up my $10,000 reward. And he was told, well, that wasn't really an official reward, but you at least have the satisfaction of knowing that you helped get this guy.
Yeah.
So he got hosed. And then the second week, we're going to be up in Cordova province. And the biggest thing up there, we have a meeting set up with the waitress who waited on Hitler and Eva Braun in 1949. And we're also going to visit an abandoned estate, and all those photos are on the website. And this is a place you had to go through a tunnel to get there, which was obviously well guarded. And people escaping from the Reich had to go there to get their new identities.
Oh, it's a big processing center.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
we're
going there.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to pictures of that. Sharkhunters.com, if you'd like to go on this tour. Looking at right now pictures of the Berghof after it was blown, and a Berghof brick. Yeah, well,
they're all over the place. People bring them home as souvenirs.
Yeah,
and the Great Steps, which was one of the things for the Berghof. This is where Hitler used to greet all his visitors.
Yes,
they're still there, but they had just been covered over with tons of dirt.
Now
the dirt is starting to erode away, and you're starting to be able to see the.
I can see the
steps coming up.
All right, Harry, thank you very much.
My fascinating.
Pleasure, that was really great. It's just a wonderful trip. Thanks, and we'll talk soon.
Very good. Thanks, Jeff. Have a great evening.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Harry Cooper, sharkhunters.com, and we'll be back.